Last Tuesday, after the riots on Monday night, self-identified gang members stood with Baltimore City Council President Jack Young to call for calm. Their behavior has sparked controversy, as some believe they need to be part of the conversation about change in Baltimore, while others hold them responsible for problems in low-income neighborhoods. In this second hour of Midday, James Timpson, director of Safe Street Park Heights, a gang violence intervention program, joins us. Plus, we hear from two representatives of the Penn North Recovery Center about how they've helped hundreds of West Baltimoreans get a second chance. And WIPR senior news analyst Fraser Smith gives us his view of the ascent of state's attorney Marilyn Mosby. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. Later in this hour, we'll welcome James Timpson back to Midday. He's the director of Safe Street Park Heights, a gang violence intervention program overseen by the Baltimore City Health Department. He'll give us some perspective on what it means to be part of a gang in Baltimore City and why they were advocating for peace last week. Also ahead, we'll hear from another West Baltimore program, the Penn North Recovery Center. The center's directors, Steve Dixon and Blaise Connolly Duggan, join us. But first, we welcome back to Midday Fraser Smith, senior news analyst at WIPR and columnist for the Daily Record. Thanks for being here, Fraser.
Good to be with you, as always, Sheila.
So I wanted to get your perspective on Marilyn Mosby and how these last few days have changed her reputation, if at all, from what people, the general public, thought when she won election last year, defeating the then incumbent Greg Bernstein.
Well, I think she's probably the overall biggest winner among the winners and losers, if there are some losers, and I think there probably are.
You're speaking in a political sense.
I am. I think people wondered if she would be up to it, and I think what she did recognized without. Actually, she wouldn't have had to say it. I mean, she stood up. She seemed very sure of herself, very strong. I think she was exactly what people were hoping for in the immediate term. The city was looking for something that would head off where it seemed to be heading. But I think also it's true of all of the political players here that there's a short-term quotient and a longer term one. And for her, it will be when all of this starts going to trial. It's very difficult for prosecutors to win cases against the police, even when you see things on film. I mean, we're sort of in the early stages of video camera evidence. But we are there, and so I think, you know.
Of course, in this case, the video that we've seen so many times of his arrest is not what State's Attorney Mosby points to as the point of his real serious injury. Her description of the chain of events is that the injury took place in the police wagon. So we really don't have video, or at least publicly, I haven't seen video that speaks to that.
Well, as a prologue, we certainly did, and it was a little ambiguous. You couldn't really tell how injured, or if he was injured, Freddie Gray was. But and I think we also don't know a lot about the evidence that she had collected from the police and from her own investigators. So we really don't know maybe what the strategy that she will use. But I say again. Whether she really is a winner will determine will depend on how she performs in court.
Let me read an email we just got that speaks to that point. This is from Mary in Baltimore City. She said, "I'd like to make the point, and I should remind listeners who might not have been with us in the last hour that we heard from Paige Crowder." A former deputy state's attorney, a retired deputy state's attorney in the city, who is quite critical of the charges that the current state's attorney brought. This This emailer, Mary, says, I'd like to make the point that if the prosecutor had charged the officers with more realistic charges, such as police brutality, excessive force, involuntary homicide, it would be more likely that the charges would stick. As it stands, most of the current charges will be tossed out, leading to more blame, confusion, and rioting. I think most people living in Baltimore City have been grossly disappointed with this Mosby, starting with the massive firing and long-term prosecutors. She appears to be more interested in self-promotion than in justice. I'm not trying to put you in the position of being her defender, but that seems to be not your conclusion.
I don't think it is. But as I said, there's a short and a long-term element in deciding who won and who lost. And I think she may regret some of these charges, which some of us have never heard of. The
depraved heart murder.
Right.
Second degree depraved heart murder.
I haven't met anybody yet who ever heard of that charge. So I don't know. I mean, again, I'm saying I think, you know what, how she performs in court in very difficult situations, even when the charges are that people like Paige Crowder and others say were faulty. I mean, I'm not a lawyer or a prosecutor. I don't know the answers to that. I just think that in that context, rightly or wrongly, you needed someone to seem very much in control, and she did. On the other hand, I think people in the city recognize how difficult this is, or how infrequent it is to get the kind of what they would regard as justice. Can be, and that's why even after the tension seemed to be reduced, you still had some demonstrations because people were saying, we want to see the end of this. We want to see this work out so that we can say to ourselves, we did get justice.
Let's talk about some of the other political fallout of the in events in Baltimore. When the National Guard was called in, many criticized Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake for not acting more quickly to get Governor Hogan's help. Former Baltimore City Mayor and Governor Martin O'Malley came to the city and faced criticism for the policing policies he practiced when he was mayor. So what are the potential consequences there?
Well, I think the mayor was in a brand new position for her. I think to some extent she was hampered. She was definitely hampered by appearing to be behind closed doors for hours, and the governor is waiting for her to say, we need you here. The looting and rioting was going on, and I think some people say, well, maybe that wouldn't have been as bad had she acted sooner. I think you're very reluctant, if you're the mayor or someone in charge, to call in somebody else and say, we can't handle this. So, you know, the images that will persist from all of that are not good for her. I think she really needs to sort of recalculate her game. And I think she needs to be more in touch with people. That's what mayors do. And on the other side of all of this, not to her benefit, is there seems to be quite a bit of support growing for former Mayor Sheila Dixon. I mean, at the funeral, there was loud applause for her and not so much for the mayor. And I think that it was partly because people see what happened to Dixon, even though she was convicted of embezzlement. I think to some extent people see that as something that the man did. That's something that the system did, rightly or wrongly. And I think—
As opposed to blaming her.
Yes, right.
That's WIPR's Fraser Smith, senior news analyst here at WIPR. On Midday, I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. And you can be part of this conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or toll free at 866-661-9309 or send us an email at midday@wipr.org. Former Governor Martin O'Malley, former mayor of Baltimore, seems to be really leaning in to the criticism that his policing policies have gotten from some. He was on NBC yesterday, Meet the Press, basically defending his practices and saying he was reelected after having done this. So he says this is something he's going to base his presidential campaign on. Is this a
in
plus?
In part. I mean, I guess
he said
it's central.
He called it central. So.
Well, he's running in a Democratic primary where a lot of the voters are African American. So he'll face this question, I'm sure. I mean, what he's famously said is that he hasn't run into a local leader yet who has complained about too much police presence. And I think all of us need to remember that there was a lot more violence. The other thing that he has said, a lot more violence before zero tolerance. But I think the other thing he said is that a lot of young black men have been saved by the reduction in crime. I mean, those numbers have been run before. So it's a bit of a wash for him, I think. And I think he gets credit for coming back to the city. And apparently he was pretty well received in the places he went. You know, he interrupted a trip. You know, do politicians interrupt their trips in Europe to come back? And so I think that was smart that he, and prudent that he did that.
What do you think the political fallout will be for Governor Hogan, who did call in the National Guard?
Well, I think Hogan looked decisive and strong, and I think it only helps him. But again, there is a second tier of this. He said he told people on the street he was going to do everything he could do. He has a very tight budget. He's already tried to cut the education spending in the city. These are not going to look like positive follow-ups.
And somebody who was an elected official, very visible over the last week or 10 days, Congressman Elijah Cummings.
Right. I think Cummings has a tremendous amount of respect, and I think he was only helped by his role in all of this. His speaking is always transfixing, actually. But again, let me say that what it does for him is forces him into making a decision he may not really want to make. I mean, the Times have occasioned this for him. They've made him seem like a strong candidate, and I think he would be. Somebody said to me earlier today,
candidate for Senate,
right? An ultimate game changer. But he's a very strong voice in the House, and he may not want to give that up. So it's a kind of a coin toss. But the risk is big. He doesn't want to give up that position he has, and yet. Here's the prospect of winning a U.S. Senate seat. So we just have to wait and see.
Mike from Baltimore is calling us. Mike, we have just a little time left, but you have a comment you want to make about Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are on the air. Welcome to
Midday. Hi, this is Michael Frazier-Smith. I appreciate that taking my call. I spent a number of years as a community organizer, also was on Monument Street during the unrest in 68 and had a little bit of experience. I want to make one comment, and that is the comment about the language that is being used. And I believe, this is my own personal feeling, that this whole issue, once this incident happened, not after the funeral, but the initial incident, I did not see outrage in our mayor on the air. I saw a polished politician, and I think that the moment that she showed her face after this young man showed up dead, that I think that there was a huge cultural and divide between the politician, her being the leader, and those in the community who the words and the experience, impression that they got in the community and that I got was not one of outrage. I personally was outraged. I personally am a contractor. I was actually working in Edmondson Village and actually drove by Mondoman every day for 2 weeks. When this incident happened, I finished my job because it didn't feel right. Because I know that people in the community can smell a rat a mile away, and this is nothing personal against the mayor, but I just think that she set the tone by not showing any public outrage over this event. And we're now living in the aftermath. We're living in the fact that the state's attorney has now taken a swift action to make a statement. And all of it is in the wake of there ain't nobody home when it comes to the empathy of our politicians. And I'll take a comment off the air or hang on, whatever.
Michael, I appreciate your call. I could imagine, and I'm certainly not a spokesperson for the mayor, that there could be an argument for being ultra calm at a time when there isn't calm on the streets. But Frazier, what do you think?
Well, I think her affect is a problem, and I think people have said that to her quite a bit. I think she sort of resists any change there. But, you know, even when we don't have a crisis, mayors really need to be close to the people. That's what mayors sort of, that's what their job is. I think she's handicapped by that. I think she does feel very deeply aggrieved by what happened to Freddie Gray. And she actually did come close to saying that in one of the press conferences she had at the beginning of the bad 10 days that we just went through. But I think she really does need to work on that. I mean, you have to feel for people. And I think this is what the caller is talking about.
And you have to be seen.
You do have to be seen.
Feeling for people. Frazier, thank you. Thanks.
Good to be with you, Sheila.
C. Frazier Smith, WIPR senior news analyst and columnist for The Daily Record. This is Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, filling in for Dan Roderick. We're going to take a short break here, and when we return, we'll be talking about gangs and the role they've played in the last week's protests. Gang members have spoken out about police brutality, stood with politicians, linked arms with members of opposing gangs. Will gang members play a role in positive change in Baltimore? Should they be held responsible for the problems of violence and drug abuse? Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Roderick. Now we turn to one group that has been outspoken in their calls for peace in Baltimore, a group whose voice is not often included in the media or condoned by politicians. I'm joined in Studio A by James Timpson, director of Safe Streets Park Heights, a gang violence intervention program overseen by the Baltimore City Health Department. James Timpson, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us briefly what it is that your group does and what you've been hearing from the gang members whom you work with.
Okay, so basically Safe Streets is a public health approach to public safety. So what we do is the major goal of our program is to reduce homicides and shootings in Baltimore City. And we do that by looking at violence as an epidemic. And we use the three-prong approach to solving, reducing homicides and shootings. Number one, we have to identify and detect the problem or the source. Two is interrupt the transmission of that. And then the third thing is to change the behaviors and norms. So first, we basically, in the communities that Safe Streets works in, what we do is we target those individuals who we know are high-risk individuals, meaning that the ones who are most likely to either perpetrate crimes or be the victims of crimes based on the type of activity that they're involved in. And then once we target those individuals, we try to interrupt actually the activities that they're doing by offering them a change, something different. And then we try to change the way that they view violence themselves. We try to change the whole community's view on violence. We try to show the community that, you know, disputes can be handled differently. It doesn't always have to end in violence. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what we do as Safe Streets.
And so when things started happening the last couple weeks in Baltimore, what did that mean for you and the people you're in touch with?
It just means that we had to get out there. We had to get out there and interrupt. That's what we do. We had to interrupt the transmission. We had to try to get involved and get in the trenches and try to, you know, mediate some of these conflicts. We knew that the police will handle their part. But we wanted to make sure that we did our part in doing what we do best, which is engaging the citizens or engaging the guys who are often on the streets are considered forgotten, the ones who nobody really wants to engage. Those are the ones that we work best with. So when things start happening, we knew that this was an opportunity for us to get in there and get in touch with some of these guys and see if we can interrupt some of the violence or some of the things that were going on.
Well, were they, the ones you were in touch with, were they heading for violence right away when protests started?
Not all, but a good majority. I think the overall feeling was just the feeling of frustration was so overwhelming that, you know, everybody was just reacting emotionally. Everybody had this built up frustration that, you know, it came out the wrong way.
So what did you do?
We got in there and started talking to people. We got in there and start seeing what we could do to help mediate some of these conflicts. I mean, a lot of what we were doing was just basically, we just tried to make our presence known out there on the streets. We got out there and we just tried to be around with situations when we saw little situations happening amongst citizens. You know, we just tried to explain the importance of this not being a time for us to be fighting each other. We have a bigger problem going on here. We need to, you know, bring some resolve or some type of calm to these little situations while we have these bigger issues going on.
If you'd like to be part of this conversation with James Timpson, director of Safe Streets Park Heights, a gang violence intervention program, give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. James, there have been some powerful images of gang members over the past few days marching together, standing with elected officials. Talk about how the community views gangs. I mean, there seems to be some people saying, okay, good that they're trying to do something constructive now, but others say, look, they're the problem. Mm-hmm. They're why we're in this mess.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing I think we oftentimes forget is Baltimore is a city of neighborhoods, not necessarily a city that should be characterized by gangs. Because no matter which neighborhood you live in, whenever you go back to that neighborhood, whatever gang you're in, your affiliation is with that neighborhood, not with a particular gang. Now, if that particular gang is the gang that predominantly runs that neighborhood, well, you may have a little issue there. But I think the community's views on them can vary. I think the way that what we see is what we've heard all along. People band together in rough times. They band together in their own little circles. And whether it be the guys on the streets, the churches, the community members, however. But the one thing that we have to remember is that, and the one thing that we tried to promote throughout all of this is that we're all together in this. This is one common cause that we're all fighting for. And I think the guys that we interacted with felt pretty much the same way. Their frustration level is what boiled over, and that's what we saw on Monday. And throughout the week, we saw a lot of frustration, a lot of anger. And that comes from decades of not being listened to. That comes from just not being heard over and over again, from being ignored, basically, and then being labeled.
What are you seeing now? After a week of that, is there still that kind of frustration boiling over? Is there something different going on?
People have optimism. You know, now they feel like they can actually be a part of the change. The problem is that we can't forget now. We can't forget them and exclude them from these conversations. The biggest thing that we tried to promote throughout the week, too, is that when we heard things going on, we wanted to make sure that the same guys who were interacting on the streets got to these different meetings, got to these different gatherings, these different events, so that their voices can be heard, so that people can understand what it is that they're frustrated about, so people can understand what it is that they say that they need. You got a lot of immediate needs out there that need to be met right now. And, you know, America's a country that's built on the survival of the fittest mentality. So if you can't survive, where do you fall? You know, and a lot of these neighborhoods, that's what we see. So, you know, the frustration level just boiled over to a point where people acted out. And we just want to make sure that now they continue to be included in that conversation for change, because that's what they're saying they want. They want to be included in the conversation for change.
Are you getting pushback from people who say they've forfeited their right to be part of the conversation about solutions?
No, I haven't actually heard that yet. I haven't heard much pushback. I think that what happened basically opened a lot of people's eyes. And they realized that this segment of society is one that we need to include in order to really foster change. Because you can't go in to anybody's situation and tell them what they need. You have to hear from them what it is that they say that they need in order to be, you know, in order to affect positive change. You have to listen. And that's the one thing that I think, you know, people finally started to do this week. They finally started to listen. People in gangs for a reason. People sell drugs for a reason. People commit crimes for a reason. I'm not saying that everybody who was out there looting or, you know, rioting and stuff like that had the right purpose in mind. We know people take advantage of every situation. But overall, it was a community's cry of frustration.
That's James Timpson, director of Safe Streets Park Heights, a gang violence intervention program overseen by the Baltimore City Health Department. Here on Midday, I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks, and you can be part of this conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Do you agree with James Timpson that gang members need to be part of the solution, that this is a moment we should not lose? Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Are you picking up some real change in the way gangs are relating to each other? Or has that been hyped in the media? There was a lot of description of gangs standing together, gangs who normally are at each other's throats standing together.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw a couple of different instances of that throughout the week. We're all citizens of Baltimore at the end of the day, no matter what gang affiliation or what religion we are or what background we come from, we're all citizens of the same city. So I think what we saw is citizens banding together to help promote positive change or try to make something different or try to get their voices heard. Because no matter which gang you're in, a lot of them face the same issues. A lot of them face the same problems every day. So I think that it was just an opportunity for like-minded people and voices that are alike to get together to express the same frustrations or to make the same cry.
Let's go to John in Baltimore City, who's calling about this issue. John, welcome to Midday.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling in reference to neighborhoods, and especially my neighborhood, when there was a big problem in my neighborhood with not people from the neighborhood. They came from other places. They set up a basketball loop and playing basketball. And the city and the police department didn't respond properly. It took very long time, like several years, to get rid of it, which, you know, when I talked to off-duty policemen, oh, that should have only taken a month. It should have been, you know, but somehow it took years and years, and the politicians from the city council to the mayor's office, they weren't doing anything. They didn't do anything. The neighborhood liaison department, they want you to go to a meeting, and they want, you know, people don't have time to go to a meeting. People have to work that night the meeting is going on. And a lot of these politicians, they're not brand new. They've been in office 10, 15, 20 years. What have they done? I know places where they tutor. Has anybody from their family volunteered to tutor or other things to help these people get jobs? They want somebody else to come out from outside and do projects, but people are tired of doing things and no result. The politicians, black and white politicians, they haven't done anything. Should be out there. Their families, 3 and 4 members of their family should be volunteering, but they want everybody else to volunteer.
Are you comfortable telling me what neighborhood or what part of town you're from?
You think it's okay to tell you?
It's okay with me. I'm asking whether it's okay with you.
Yeah, I guess it is. Waverly.
Okay. What ultimately solved the problem? I get the impression from what you told us that it took a long, long time, but the problem has been solved.
The problem was solved. I would call the headquarters. They told me they had nothing to do with it. I should call my district. And, you know, maybe I would tell them I'm not calling there. I have called so many times. And then headquarters would say, call me back in half hour. I'm going to call them and talk to them now. So I would call it back. I would put timers and call back in half hour. And, nobody call you from your district? No, nobody call me.
I'm trying to understand, John, what from your perspective ultimately made a difference. I mean, I understand that you feel like you got a big runaround, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm trying to understand whether what eventually happened
was something that
could have happened much earlier.
A few people got evicted. They lost their house, so they moved. Somebody a couple houses like that moved out because of had to relocate, and some end up in jail. So it completely changed the environment in the neighborhood.
Let me ask James Timpson what you would say to somebody like John, not in your part of town, but concerned about some of the things that concern you. What kind of advice would you give him?
I can only speak about what we actually do. I mean, we just try to engage, you know, and I know everybody's not comfortable with engaging those who, you know, they portray as gang members or living those type of lives. But at the end of the day, again, the point is that we're all still citizens of this city. So, I mean, everybody has particular needs. I can't speak to that specific situation because...
Because you're very focused on the exact place where you are.
Not even that too, but at the same time, that sounds like a more of a, I don't know what actually goes on in his neighborhood. I don't know what type of community activist work that they do, or what, I don't know how they handle those particular situations. But in our particular neighborhood, what I'm saying is that we would try to engage those, because usually it's young people, we would try to engage them and figure out what it is we can do to help out, to help them make better choices, or to see, you know, how we can do things differently. I mean, people have a reason for banning gangs and the things that they do.
John, I appreciate your calling. Thank you. James, before we have to take a break, how do you think communities can keep positive momentum, calls for reform, justice, community engagement? How can we keep this moment going?
The biggest part you said right there at the end was the community engagement piece. We have to just keep people engaged in what's going on in the communities, and that's not excluding people who we label as gang members or people who we label as criminals or whatever the case may be, because if they're in your community, they're a part of your community. The biggest part is that you need to keep people engaged so that they can make sure that they're part of the conversation about the change. Because everybody's views and everybody's ideas are different as to what they need. Again, like I said, there are a lot of immediate needs out there right now for food, clothes, shelter, things like that, that just aren't met on a daily basis, which causes people to live the lives that they live sometimes. And again, it's not condoning anything, but it's a reality of what we see every day when we're out there interacting with different people on the streets.
James Timpson, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot. James Timpson directs Safe Streets Park Heights. When we come back, a clinic, a community center, a hub for those living in a community facing many problems. Midday hears from the directors of the Penn North Recovery Center about how they've worked to give second chances to hundreds of people in West Baltimore. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. We're joined now by Steve Dixon and Blaise Connolly Duggan, the directors of the Penn North Recovery Center. Their main office and clinic is located near the CVS that was destroyed in a fire last Monday. I appreciate your joining us, both of you, and I just let me remind our listeners, you can be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or... if you're further away, call toll-free at 866-661-9309 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. So, Steve Dixon, let me start with you. I don't know that much about the Penn North Recovery Center. Give me the short version of what you do.
Well, we've been a treatment center on Pennsylvania Avenue for over 22 years. We're acupuncture-based modality. We don't do methadone or Suboxone or anything like that. Group counseling, individual counseling, acupuncture, and around the corner we have a community resource center that services over 600 people a day, 12-step meetings, community service, workforce development, resume writing, and we house over 170 people there as well.
It's transitional housing.
Supportive housing, similar, very similar. Mm-hmm.
So... Blaise Connolly Duggan, you serve hundreds of people.
Thousands.
Thousands. What have these last few weeks been like?
It's interesting. We actually started several months ago planning a broader campaign for the neighborhood of Sandtown. We've been working with our local politicians and reaching out to other organizations in the area on the heels of the report from the Justice Policy Institute and the governor's announcement of declaring a heroin epidemic across the state. So we've been very involved in those initiatives, and we've actually been looking at ways to bring broader investment and broader focus into Sandtown.
To create jobs or investment in
jobs and housing, really expanding from the base of our program. We really have we have five pieces of our pie that we focus on right now, which are healthcare, focusing mainly on substance abuse and behavioral health, mental health treatment, housing, jobs, outreach and advocacy, and peer mentorship and support. And those are the things that are needed throughout the community, not just for the individuals that we serve who are dealing with issues of recovery and addiction.
So here you are working this hard and touching so many lives. Did you see the unrest coming? Did it blindside you? I mean, what were you doing when the protest started? What were you doing when the violent protest started?
Well, we actually were at the exact moment. We were the host of Freddie Gray's family after the funeral, after the burial. We had the repast on Monday, which is the family comes and eats and sits around and meditates and does other things. So we were there, had probably about 200, 250 people, including the stepfather and the twin sister. So when the unrest started, we were actually there. And we were the safest place that you could possibly be at our community resource center during that time.
I can see it's a safe place, but mm-hmm. What went through your mind?
Well, we immediately had to send someone around the corner to lock up our clinical facility, which is located on Pennsylvania Avenue, 2410, steps from the corner, steps from the CVS. The reports came in from people who had been out on the streets. They came into the event that we were having with the family and announced that the CVS had been broken into before it was on fire, and that a police car had been set on fire. So we put everybody on lockdown inside the building, and it was an amazing experience because it was so tender, I guess, and spiritual and inspirational, being with the family immediately after the funeral and having the ties to the community and to Freddie Gray's family and friends that we have through the center. And yet to see all the unrest and activity that was taking place just steps from our front door.
So how do you put those two forces together in your head? I mean, how do you make sense of it, and how do you move on from that?
For me, I understand, because it's a lot of frustration in that community. It's undereducated, underemployed, and people feel undervalued. So absolutely everything that happened was wrong, but they were making a statement. So now that statement has awakened the world. So people need to come see what's really happening there. We need business development. We need people to come to Penn North to understand that these are not animals, these are not savages, these are human beings that have needs. And they need, you come through that community, it's thousands of boarded up buildings. And we need those buildings. We need developers to come in, and we need to partner with them and create an economic development zone that can change the situation. You wouldn't have that situation happen again.
You're nodding, Blaise. You agree?
Absolutely. And going back, it's one of the things that we've been saying for a long time. The demand for our services is almost insatiable. And so we've been looking to expand. We've actually been trying to acquire properties, renovate properties, and actually buy. We're located in the original Frederick Douglass High School building. The cultural significance of that building and its footprint in that neighborhood is incredibly important and a valuable
piece. Am I right that that's the building where Thurgood Marshall went
to school? Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Could possibly be the second oldest African-American high school in the United States, because before, African-Americans weren't allowed to go to high school. So it's a possibility that Billie Holiday sang on that stage. Cab Calloway graduated from that school, Thurgood Marshall, and many, many other icons. Also, it's the home of Coppin State College, the original home of Coppin State College before they moved to North Avenue. So the significance of that building and the program that we're building in that building, in that place, it could be the footprint for Sandtown to start the revitalization of Sandtown.
So there must be some listeners who hear, Steve Dixon, hear you say, we need investors to come and repair these vacant homes and open them again. And they're like, folks, the CVS was just burned. Do you really expect investors to come to this area?
Well, that was out of frustration. Once you turn the economic conditions around, and the socioeconomic conditions on the whole, once people begin getting educations and people start having jobs, people start having healthy places to live, those things won't happen again. That was just out of frustration.
You're describing a virtuous circle, but how do we get from the vicious circle to the virtuous circle? I mean, do you feel like that corner has been turned, or what has to happen to turn that corner?
I believe what we saw going from Monday night into Tuesday morning and what carried on throughout the week is actually in that neighborhood on those blocks of Pennsylvania Avenue, Cumberland, Carey Street. Incredible positivity surrounding the playground and the park there. We had magician David Blaine out there doing tricks for little kids. So to me, it was a sign of what's possible of redevelopment in that neighborhood. And I should add, redevelopment without displacement, taking care and providing the services that the citizens who have been there, the residents who have been there their whole lives, providing the services that they need. We've been trying to raise money to purchase the Douglas building for quite some time now, and it's been incredibly difficult to get that level of investment in that neighborhood. And I think the positivity that's come out of this tragedy, that people can actually see. There's been so many visitors who have come into that neighborhood who have probably never been there before, never even knew it existed, with all eyes on it. I think there is a moment of opportunity to bring in private investment, to rally the foundations and government agencies to really do something significant.
That's Blaise Connolly Duggan here on Midday on WYPR. He and Steve Dixon are directors of the Penn North Recovery Center. Steve Dixon is with us also. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan Rodericks, and we'd like you to be part of the conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780, toll free at 866-661-9309, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Steve, you used a phrase a minute ago that's going to stick with me about mm-hmm. people feeling undervalued. You were explaining what erupted last week. Has there been any material change in that feeling in the community?
Well, I think so. If you came out on Friday night, if you came out on Saturday night, and you saw, for example, the cast from Center Stage, mm-hmm. Marley came Beautiful. And sang in the middle of the street. You see the bands playing in the middle of the street. People are listening. Reporters will stop me from Germany, Canada, the Globe and Mail in Canada, the largest paper in Canada, came from Australia. So now the world is watching. So now these people know that somebody cares. People are coming from all over, dropping off donations. So now they understand that people care. What we have to be careful of is when the cameras go away.
It's just what I was going to ask you about. How do you manage that?
Well, you have to have somebody who stays and cares, and that's what Blaise and myself are going to do. We're not going to leave Sandtown. We're not going to leave Penn North. We're going to be there, and we're in it for the long haul. I grabbed Governor Larry Hogan's hand the day after the fire at CVS. I stopped him outside of CVS. I looked him in his eye, and I said, when the cameras are gone, make sure you come back.
He said?
He said, I will. He tried to get away from me, and I said, make sure you do. So I believe the world is watching now, so it's nowhere in the world.
But the world doesn't tend to watch very long anywhere.
You know, in the media, they call it having legs. So, you know, we're not concerned with that. We're going to push forward. And all of the articles, the New York Times talks about having two Baltimores. You cannot have two Baltimores. You have to have one Baltimore. And in order to have one Baltimore, the other part of Baltimore absolutely has to look like Federal Hill, Fells Point, Canton. All of Baltimore has to look that way and has to feel that way so everybody can feel safe. So it's in everybody's interest to invest in that one Baltimore.
A few other people over the course of these last couple hours have talked about the concern that the, I'll call it elation from some of the conversations I had in the community about the charges that State's Attorney Mosby brought. What happens if there are not convictions? How do you read that? How do you read how much of a powder keg is still there?
Well, I think if everybody comes in and does their part, that powder keg will simmer down. You know, Congressman Cummings came out every night. He had a powerful effect on the community. Nick Mosby came every night.
City Councilman.
Yes. And that's his district. He came every night. So if these people continue to come, you cannot ignore a neighborhood and think that it's not going to blow up. If people come, the private investors come, the corporate investors come, the government comes, and you pay attention to this, we're now getting ready to open up a safe zone for children and a recreation center for children. So that's our next step. So if you you can't take away recreation centers from children. Baltimore City has only created one brand new recreation for children in the past 20 years, and that was about 2 years ago. And most of them have been closed down, and they've been trying to rent them out to different organizations. That hasn't happened very successfully on a small level. But we're going to create a recreation center, a safe zone for children. So these are the steps that you have to take. So this will kill the paddle cake.
How do you get the funding for what you do?
Donations from a lot of individuals, concerned folks actually all around the country. As Steve said, as we've been on some of the national media, people have been sending in small donations from all around the country. We're funded in part by the city. We've got several different revenue streams, but I want to go back just quickly. I don't know when that decision will come down, whether there's a conviction or not, but I think
the legal decision in the case of the officers.
There's a moment of opportunity, I think, for a show of good faith, some way to take a stand and to show that this won't go away with this case, that this is bigger than this case, that this is about a community, this is about communities like this all around the country. And I think there's an opportunity to say, we're going to do something. And I think if folks in the neighborhood see that there's a real commitment on the part of political leadership and investors and folks, that will go a long way to saying, you know, regardless of what happens with the case.
We've got just like a half minute left. What particular thing will you be watching for to be that symbol? Oh, you'll know it when you see it.
I think word that CVS is coming back and is going to hire people in the community, people at the Penn North Recovery Center to participate in the rebuilding. I think things like that would be good signs.
A good note on which to end. I really appreciate you both talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you.
Steve Dixon and Blaise Connolly-Duggan, director of the Penn North Recovery Center. I want to thank you both for being here, and I want to wish you good luck. And I want to thank you for listening. Thank you to everyone who called in or emailed. I'm Sheila Cast, host of Maryland Morning on WYPR. Dan Rodericks will be back for tomorrow's edition of Midday. Stay tuned now for the news from NPR.